And now, with Sound Investing, here's Paul Merriman.
Before I get into today's podcast, I just want to stop for a second and thank Chris Pederson for the terrific job he did for the Orange County AAII. 2 hours of great work, about an hour and a half of presentation, about a half an hour of Q&A, and I thought it was terrific. So I want to thank Orange County for giving Chris this opportunity, and to Chris for taking advantage of it. And we had, and I'll say we because I did all I could to get folks out, but there were about almost 650 people who came to watch Chris's presentation. Now, that's good news. There's even bigger news as far as I'm concerned, and that is there were some 1,400 plus who signed up. So eventually, all 1,400, I hope, will be sent a link to the presentation. And by the way, what they said was that it will be 2 to 4 weeks before AAII will have a chance to do the editing and have the MP4 ready for distribution. In the meantime, we got dozens and dozens of great questions. And so we're going to make some podcasts. Some Chris and I will do, some all three of us, including Daryl, will do, and maybe even one that I will do. But we do want to answer those questions that we didn't have time, I should say Chris didn't have time to answer on Saturday. So thanks for coming out. I hope when this thing is ready to be the copy to be sent, whether it's the podcast or the MP4 of the whole presentation, I hope you will share it with others. Just so you'll know, if you didn't look at the promotional piece, he talked about ETF selection, he talked about asset allocation, the diversification, not only of different equity asset classes, but also of fixed income and equity, and he talked about investor behavior. All three of these things have a huge impact on the returns that you will get, and I just think that Chris is truly one of the best presenters. He's so easy to listen to. You know, I'm kind of on my high horse the whole time, but it's much simpler, I think, more relaxed, and I just want to thank Chris for what he did. Now, today, I have just a very important topic, and Rich and I just wrote an article, and we are submitting it today to the people at MarketWatch. And the article and this podcast is about some of the worst investment advice that I know. And I think while you might not have quantified terrible investment advice, and I'll try to do that here, I don't think any of this is going to come as a shock to you. But to the extent that you have friends or family that might be attracted to the kind of a sales pitch that I'll be addressing on today's podcast, my hope is that you'll pass this on. I'll try not to talk forever so that whoever you pass it on to won't fall asleep. I'll get to the points, make them quickly, but I think this is a very important piece of information to get into the hands of people who are being lured in to the investments that are, let's call them, some of the favorites of Wall Street, some of the favorites of people who are not necessarily right on Wall Street, but on the edges of Wall Street and making a living somehow I would say, preaching these kinds of attempts to invest and invest in what I consider to be a bad way. And when I say a bad way, I am simply referring to how you as an investor are likely to do if you follow the advice that I consider to be some of the worst in the industry. Now, I will also say that when I say the worst in the industry, I'm not suggesting that there aren't people who are going to lose everything doing other things. Like, it's terrible if you get into a Ponzi scheme. It's even terrible when you buy lottery tickets because you could be in taking that money and investing it. But really what I want to focus on here is an approach to investing that is being sold to tens of millions of investors with the pitch being that this is the best thing. This is the best way to put your money to work. Now, before I talk about this terrible advice, I want to make sure you understand what's kind of always on my mind. Table one is always on my mind when I'm looking at a fork in the road. Table one, by the way, we have lots of table ones, but this is the table one that shows the impact of an additional 0.5% in annual return. I suspect you've all seen it, and we'll have a link to it. And table one simply shows that if over a 40-year period, you got an 8% return during the accumulation period and a 6% return during the distribution period of your life, and you put away $6,000 over a 40-year period. It says, how much would you have if you did that for 40 years and you got an 8% return and then you stopped putting money in and you started taking out 4% a year for the rest of your life and you continued to get that 6% in retirement? Well, I can tell you the bottom line. Between if you lived until you're 95, so it's 40 years of accumulation and 30 years of distributions, you would have a total of withdrawals plus what you leave to your heirs of $5.5 million on that investment of $240,000. That's just pure compounding. Obviously, we don't know an investment that pays 8% every year for 40 and then 6%, but these are long-term kinds of compounded rates that, based on history, are certainly legitimate. Now, we then look, after having identified the value of this $240,000 growing at 8% and then growing at 6% and taking 4% out in retirement, we know that all adds up to $5.5 million. If we could find an extra 0.5% and get 8.5% during the accumulation and 6.5% during the distribution instead of $5.5 million, it is $7 million. And that would be a $1.5 million difference. And so when we know young people who are just getting started, whether they're in their 20s or their 30s, I mean, the bottom line is we want to make sure that they understand there are some really easy ways to make more money, depending on whose advice that you take. And then we take it one step further in the famous table two. And in table two, all we did was make another 0.5%. And the point that we want to make about another 0.5% is that you don't just double that advantage, because instead of 1.5 going to 3 million, it's 1.5 goes to 3.5 million. So if you could find a way to make an extra 1% during the accumulation, during the distribution periods, how would you do? Well, here's my point. Here's what I'm wanting to talk about in terms of the worst investment advice that I know. Investment advice, as I said earlier, that impacts tens of millions of people. And it is advice that comes through major brokerage firms like Merrill Lynch and Morgan Stanley. Now, by the way, I want to be very careful here because you can go to Merrill Lynch, and I'm sure they have advisors that recommend the very kind of thing that we recommend for very wealthy people. I'm not all concerned about wealthy people who already have it. The greater concern for me in the work that we do is for people who may want it and do not have it. And so it is really important that you do those things that are in your best interest. So I see the big firms, the big brokerage firms, and the big firms like Fisher Investments. You know, they have over 135,000 people as clients. That's what they say on the internet. And so, from my viewpoint, that's 135,000 people who could likely be doing much better. And by the way, I am not suggesting for one second that there's anything dishonest about what Fisher is recommending. I'm just saying that when I look at some of the expenses to get what you get from them, it becomes questionable. But it is really questionable when I see people telling young investors, or even investors who maybe aren't young, but they're inexperienced, they're going to get a rollover on an IRA, and they're going to put that to work, and it's not just a little bit of money, but they aren't experienced. So here is what I want you to understand, that when somebody takes the position that paying a load is a good thing, I just want you to understand that paying a load is not a good thing. Because paying a load, which typically for a smaller accounts, is going to be somewhere around 5.75%. That is 5.75%, let's just talk about a $10,000 investment, that is $575 guaranteed never to make you a penny more the rest of your life. In fact, it's just gone. And it's gone because somebody is giving you the advice that is what is in your best interest. Now, what do we know about that $575? Well, number one, if you had that in your pocket and you invested it just in the S&P 500, you would be able historically to get a 10% compound rate of return. And so that's the first thing that's wrong. But that's not the catastrophic thing. That isn't necessarily the thing that's going to cost you $2, $3, $4, $5 million over your lifetime. It is what happens when you put money into a load fund. Typically, the reason somebody is able to sell you a load fund is because they believe that load mutual fund is going to be able to produce a return that will be better than if you put your money into an index fund. Well, there are lots of people who believe that. I mean, I've heard, and by the way, I'm not picking on Dave Ramsey when I say this, but I've heard him say that he has the ability to pick mutual funds that will do 2% better than the index funds. And I also know that the Standard & Poor's organization puts out a report every 6 months that looks at the last year, the last 3, 5, 10, 15, and 20 years. And it shows how many of the actively managed funds, not the index funds, because we know about what the index funds are going to make. They're going to make what the market makes. We'll call that the benchmark. Now, those index funds at Fidelity may have no operating expense, in which case you're in theory making the whole amount. But if you go to a Vanguard or a BlackRock or those kinds of firms and you get an ETF that replicates the S&P 500, the expense ratio is 0.03%. So it's pretty doggone close to being free. So one of the reasons I'm excited for young people is that today, compared to when I was young, they're giving money away. Well, it's not that they're really giving money away. It's just that they were taking a lot of money that now you're able to capture for yourself instead of somebody else getting that money. So you pay the load, and so you end up in an actively managed fund that every person who recommends an actively managed fund believes theoretically it's going to be better than an index fund, even though the SPIVA report shows that less than 1 out of 10 mutual funds that are actively managed are able to beat the benchmark. Well, if that's the case, unless people are able to see the future out 20 years, and can tell you what those actively managed funds are going to make. Oh, yeah, like I know who's going to be managing those actively managed funds. As a matter of fact, at the end of 20 years, about half of the mutual funds that were around 20 years ago are no longer in business. So not only am I not likely to have the same active manager over 20 years, more than likely, or about there's a 50-50 chance that the fund will have had performance that was bad enough that they closed the sucker down, because people were getting out and it was hard to sell bad performance. Now, having said that, you may be surprised to find out that while the index fund is I can't say guaranteed, in fact, it won't make more than the benchmark, it's supposed to be like the benchmark, less some very small fee. But in the actively managed fund, understand there are funds in the top quartile at the end of 20 years or 10 years or 1 year. And oh, by the way, yes, 1 year at a time, the index funds only do better than about half of the actively managed funds. So on a short-term basis, there will be a lot of funds that do better than the index. But the further out we go, the narrower that difference becomes, to the extent that less than 1 out of 10, in fact, on a risk-adjusted basis, it's less than 1 out of 20 is able to do as well as the benchmark. But when you look at the returns, if you look at the SPIVA report, and we're going to have a link in the notes to the SPIVA report, and you're going to dig in, you're going to scroll down, and you're going to see some things that will, I think, be kind of shocking, because it isn't just that the actively managed mutual funds don't beat the benchmark. It is that so many of them not only don't beat it, but they lag it by as much as 2% a year and more. And while Bill Miller beat the S&P 500 1 year after a time for 15 years and billions of dollars flowed in under his management, what happened next, and this happens to actively managed funds often, he became the worst. I mean, what made him the best was he did things differently. What made it be the worst was he did things differently, but in the second case, they didn't work out. And so when you're in any actively managed fund, there is a chance you're not going to do well. And part of the reason you're not going to do well are the expenses. I looked at a fund that I know that in the past, and by the way, it is hard to find, in this particular case, I'm talking about Dave Ramsey. I can't find what he was recommending 10 years ago, but I know that a fund that he has liked in the past is the Investment Company of America, out of the American Funds family. Now, this is a legitimate, it's got over $100 billion under management, okay? That is a lot of confidence. Somebody likes that fund. But here's what I know. I know that the people in that fund pay 0.58% a year. In other words, 58 basis points. There's 100 basis points in 1%. And this is 0.58 of 1%. But if you invested in the Vanguard S&P 500 fund as a mutual fund, not an ETF, you would have paid 4 one-hundredths, not 40, but 4 one-hundredths. And if you used an ETF, you would have paid 3 one-hundredths of 1% to get in the asset class that, as a matter of fact, over the last 15 years, the S&P 500, this is according to Morningstar, made 9.67%. That's what the American Investment Company of America made, 9.67%. The category average, now not the index, the average of all of the actively managed funds, 9.99. So not only did they not get as much as the index. Oh, I haven't told you the index return, 11.11. So 9.67 versus 11.11% versus 9.5. It's approximately 1.5% difference. And I'm jumping up telling you that I think 0.5% would be a really big deal, an extra 1.5 million. Here we're talking about 1.5%. And you paid a load, which really, if you look at it carefully, is about 0.5% a year. So now between the load and the lower returns of the American fund, we're up to a 2% difference. Now, it gets worse. Now, some of the things that are buried in that 1.5% difference in returns are the higher expenses and the cost of turnover, the buying and the selling that goes on. And part of it is just that they didn't pick stocks that did as well as owning all of them. But it's a portfolio, what they call large cap blend. But here's where it gets worse. And see, nobody's going to tell you this that is trying to sell you this. And this is the challenge. My friend George Sisti, who has got to have at least 100 quotes that I think are great. And I don't think this is necessarily his original quote, but a half-truth is a lie. And so to tell people about what a great fund this is And by the way, the only thing we really know is when we say it's a great fund, because anybody could simply look over the Morningstar data and say, here is the best large cap blend fund over the last 10, 20, whatever, 15 years. You can go up to 15 years on the free Morningstar database, and you could find a few funds that did better for the S&P 500 than the index. The problem is that you can't buy that. You see, what you will end up buying may be 1% less, 2% less. Whereas if you buy the index, you're going to get what it makes and know that you are likely to be amongst the best. But if it's in a taxable account, it's important for you to know that according to Morningstar, the Investment Company of America Fund, over the last 3 years, that's what they show, over the last 3 years, you would have lost 1.22% a year in taxes because of capital gains and other kinds of distributions. Now, that assumes you're in a higher income tax bracket, so it might not cost you 1.22%, but for somebody it does. And for somebody in that same bracket, the S&P 500 fund would cost 0.37% in returns. So potentially for some people, this in this case taxable people, you would have made another almost 1%. Now you're potentially up to 3%. And then you might ask, well, okay, but maybe just maybe the S&P 500 was more risky, and the reason it made all this additional money is because it's more risky. And I would say, I don't think so. Now, there's a whole bunch of ways that we can identify risk. But one way is to look at how much diversification there is in a mutual fund. I know, for example, in the case of the S&P 500, that it's going to be approximately 500. But you don't know how many unless you look it up is in the Investment Company of America. I looked it up and it's about 200, which means not only are you making theoretically more than, what, maybe 3% more per year, but you're doing it with less risk because you got 500 companies instead of 200. Now, what will also show up in that return difference will be anything that is a drag on performance. Is there anything that the Investment Company of America is doing that would cause us not to make more money? And the one thing that you'll find out, and you can see it both in the turnover, the buying and selling inside of the Investment Company of America is many times that of the S&P 500, but they also sit on a bunch of cash. About, according to Morningstar right now, about 5%. Well, what's wrong with having 5%? First of all, you might ask, why do they have 5%? And one reason could be, in theory, they're looking for some really great buys, and they want to have some money available to take advantage of those buys. But what happens is that if, on average, over a long period of time, you're sitting on 5% in cash, that's 5% that's not getting 10% in earnings. It's 5% that might be getting almost nothing until interest rates recently went up. So that's another drag. You've got the load drag. You've got the taxes drag. You've got the expenses drag. You've got the buying and selling drag. And yet, a salesperson can sit there and say to you, without cracking a smile, this is the best fund I know for you. If you want to be in a good, diversified, large cap blend fund, this is what you should do. Well, this is what many people are going to do because they won't take the time to learn how to do this themselves. Now, I will tell you a way. Remember that $575 that it cost you in a commission? All right, you are not willing to do the homework. You want somebody who will do it, and you'd like them not to charge you more than $575. Because the salesman said, you know, whether you go have somebody manage it for you, or you buy it with a no-load fund, or you hire us with a load fund, it's going to cost you some money. So how about if when you came to that fork in the road that you were going to hire somebody, you saw that there were two choices. One choice was to hire somebody that's going to charge you 1% a year to manage it, or you're going to pay somebody 5.75% to put you into a load fund. But there is a third door you could go through, and that is the people who charge, you know, $200, $300, sometimes $400. I even know some hourly advisors who charge $450. But let me just tell you the difference. The difference is they're going to recommend funds that have low expenses, low turnover, low taxes, little to no cash sitting around, more diversification, because they are probably, if they're worth the money you pay them, recommending index funds to you. Now, that would still cost you money, but at least the mutual funds you are in are likely to make you a higher rate of return and charge you less in taxes and reduce the risk because you'll have more diversification. And by the way, once you get into that index fund, you don't have to worry about the mutual fund manager dying and not being there to carry on. Now you may have a hard time believing that somebody who cared about you would do something that would cost you 3 or 4% a year for the rest of your life. And I'm just here to say that for some people to make a living in the industry, they have chosen the route where you might, if you do a great sales job, make a ton of money. I have known people who sell indexed annuities, for example, or other very high commission products that make over $1 million a year. And that's because they are helping people invest in things that really are expensive. And by the way, the harder a product is to sell, the higher the commission for the salesperson, because you got to motivate them. You must get their attention. They must get you at the top of the list and have some reason that you would choose their investment over some other investment. And guess what? It turns out that commission might be the reason in some cases. Now, I don't think there's, I cannot think of another place that professionals work where they would go out of their way to do something than what is absolutely in your best interest. Well, for example, how would you feel about going to a doctor or an attorney or an accountant where they had ways to make three, four, five times as much money off of you, but what you got was going to be an inferior product? Now, you need to understand something, because it may just be kind of beyond belief that there could be this difference. You may think that there's something that, some bias that I have that I just don't get it. But I'll tell you what I know intimately is I know what this industry was like in 1966 when I came into the industry. What Wall Street is getting today is peanuts compared to what they used to get. It wasn't a 5.75% load. It was an 8.5% load. The expenses were higher. And virtually everybody was, well, in fact, everybody was active management. There was nowhere for you to turn. And the people who were selling you those products at all those major investment houses, and I worked at one for a couple of years in the 60s, there was nobody, or almost nobody, that was acting as a fiduciary legally, because they were selling products that had huge conflicts of interest. And the thing is about these conflicts of interest, you would think that there would be some responsibility for these people who are helping you buy these funds that have a load and have a high expense ratio and have high taxes and are more risky because they have less diversification. You would think that they would have some responsibility to tell you, I just want you to know that there's a very good likelihood that you are going to make somewhere between maybe somewhere between 1 and 3% less. And oh, by the way, if you compound money over the rest of your life, however old that person might be, that means the difference in what you might get from my recommendations and other recommendations could be $3 or $4 million. Could you give me the list, please, of the people that might make me another $3 or $4 million? And you might say, well, why is this so difficult for people to get? Well, I can tell you, if as we were driving home here on Bainbridge Island and we're going up the road, we go along High School Road and we see the cost of gas at the corner of High School Road and 305. And we keep driving and we come to another place where we run into several miles further on to another gas station that's posted their gas price. Ah, and it's about the same. And then you keep going and you drive to Paulsbo where you can get gas at Safeway. And the sign says, instead of $5 a gallon, $4.50. Well, it's always something, 0.99, 0.9 or something. But anyway, you got it. There could be a huge difference. Well, okay, am I going to drive all the way to Paulsbo to pick up that extra 50 cents a gallon? And most people from Bainbridge probably won't. Many of us oftentimes drive through Paulsbo to get other places, and so we just put that into our planning. But if that first gas station, the price was $5. And right next to it was another gas station with a price of $4.50. Which one would people be buying? They'd be buying the $4.50 because it was so easy to know. And then when somebody would say, oh yeah, that's just a matter of difference of quality of the gas. That gas at 500, that's a better quality gas. I'm told that Safeway's quality gas is just as good as that place down on 305 and High School Road. I wouldn't know how to test that. But you get the idea. If we all had the ability to see a list, what are the tax implications? How much diversification? What's the turnover? Because that buying and selling, not only does it cost you in taxes if you're in a taxable account, but it costs you in internal expenses inside of the mutual fund. How much in cash are they sitting on that's going to be a drag? You can see if this was all right there for you to compare. And it is right there in Morningstar. But it's going to take you maybe a little time to drag that out. In fact, if you said to the person at Merrill Lynch or wherever, look, I understand you have to make a living. I understand that these index funds that have lower expenses and better long-term returns and blah, 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 I'd be better off in those. Is there any way you could get me those instead? And they would say, they can't lie. You know, they'll have a problem now. And they'll say, yes, I could. Well, how can you do that? Well, I could help you put together 4 or 5 ETFs, exchange-traded funds. Our brokerage arm does that. They allow people to buy and sell stocks, and you could pay a commission to buy one of those ETFs that has broad diversification, looks like the S&P 500, has low expenses and all those things you want. And you say, well, you know, I'd like to do that. How much will you make, if you don't mind me asking? Because I know how much you'll make going this other route. And they'll say, well, one of the reasons, you know, we can't do that is because the only thing we'd be able to charge you is a commission, and the commissions for the trade to set you up in these 5 investments that you could hold forever and never have to do anything about would cost, I don't know, maybe $200. But I'll tell you quite honestly, I really don't have the time to have you as a client if all I'm going to make is $200 every, by the way, they don't let me keep the $200. They want to keep 60% of it. So I'm really only making $80 for all the time I would spend with you. And I got to be honest, I can only have about 150 accounts. And if I have more than 150, it doesn't make any sense for me to, I can't give people the service they should have. And so really what I have to do, I'm sorry to tell you this, but you're reading between the lines, I'm sure, on this. What is really happening here is I really have to look for people who are going to believe that my looking over mutual funds and understanding them that are actively managed has a high probability of doing better than the index fund. But, you know, as you can see, it may mean in reality that I got to make you more than 3% a year. And I don't know anybody that's done that. So you get it. I know you get it. And the challenge is that you really want to keep all of the money. Now, let me give you another reality. There are people like me who understand all of this I want nothing but index-like funds in my portfolio. I want somebody else to do it. I want somebody else who will give me tax advice. I want somebody else that will make sure I'm diversified amongst different equity asset classes, etc. And I'm willing to pay to have somebody do all of that for me. But the fact is, they're going to put me in the right kind of funds, the same kind of funds as that person who you are going to pay a few hundred bucks an hour. And you might say, and I'll just say this is the reality, who wouldn't want to have that kind of an advisor? Well, I can tell you the problem is that once they give you that advice, they expect you to do it. And they expect you not to jump in and second guess anything, because they're giving you advice to stay the course. The thing about having somebody you pay to be your advisor is they are creating guardrails for people who are emotionally weak when it comes to seeing their money. They like it when it goes up, but they start feeling insecure when it goes down. And I can talk intimately about this feeling because I'm one of those people. And so I know myself well enough that I would be second guessing. And so my advice is, if you're a second guesser and likely to overrule what that advisor says to do, great, find somebody to do it either hourly or assets under management, a percentage, but make doggone sure they are using the kind of mutual funds that smart people, people in the academic community, by the way, I have talked to so many retired stockbrokers, and every time I find one who will talk to me, I will ask them what they're doing with their investments in retirement, and in almost every case, they put it into index funds, which is not what they were doing when they were in the industry. They get it. And you get it. And the question is how you get there. And maybe you don't get to save the whole 4%. But if you could save most of it, it would be to your advantage. And by the way, I like somebody who takes care of the tax loss harvesting. I don't have to call up and discuss it with my advisor. They just do it. So I really do believe that when I talk about this is the worst investment advice in the industry, it is the worst because I know the people who are doing it know exactly what they're doing. And that they could, if they were willing to make less. And you may think that I'm overstating that, but let me just tell you that they say that John Bogle died being worth about $90 million. Even though he built one of the biggest two or three mutual fund companies in the U.S., the others who have done that or anything close to it are worth billions and billions of dollars. And why was he only worth $90 million? Because he was doing the right thing for the investors. And when he started doing the right thing for the investors, the industry, they didn't hate him, but they did everything they can. You know the kind of things that the Republicans and the Democrats do to each other to make you feel uneasy about looking at possibly voting for that other person? They do the same thing in this industry. And in fact, they are getting more and more clever every day. My wife and I went to look at a car, a Honda, a hybrid. And the next morning, I opened up my computer, and somehow, for the first time, I started getting ads for Hondas. How did they know that? Well, I had to look up the address to go to that place. So my computer knows he's looking at Hondas. Must have some cash in his pocket, or he's got good credit. All right, let's see if we can somehow make some money while we get him to do what he's thinking about. I don't want to be a cynic about everybody's intentions. It's easy to do. But I will tell you from everything that I know, there are a few things that we can do, and we can do them once carefully. It's what we're trying to teach to the students at Western Washington University. It's the reason we want every student at Western to be required to take a course that would make them more financially literate. My hope is that one thing they will know coming out of there is that index funds are in their best interest. I am hoping that they will believe that equities are the best place to be with long-term money when you're in your 20s. And they will believe that if the market goes down and you're putting money into index funds, that it's a good thing to keep investing. And when people are calling to try to entice them with cryptocurrency or Robinhood, you know, it's interesting. I don't know if you listen to the Hidden Brain, but I'm gonna include a link to a couple of Hidden Brain episodes that talk about what the industry, the psychologists have learned about the impact on the brain of being hit with advertising and creating beliefs that you will make a whole bunch of money real fast. And then what happens even after that happens, what happens to your brain? What mode does it go into? And what are the implications of that mode? And it gets into a discussion of addiction. Now, I'm not suggesting that everybody's going to get addicted to trading the market. But I do know that, I don't know if Robinhood is still doing this, but Robinhood was out there giving money on college campuses, I think $15 to students to start trading, start learning how to trade, get that dopamine running. I mean, it's a slippery slope. It's hard to know the difference between people selling you something that is in your best interest, and sometimes what they're doing is they're just simply trying to feather their own nest. And so my view is, if there's just a handful of things, by the way, that is what we're talking, millions, 12 simple ways to supercharge your retirement. That book is about some forks in the road that you don't want somebody who doesn't absolutely have your best interest at heart getting in the way of making those 12. And even if you end up believing a couple of them, like indexing, that's great. Target date funds that use indexes, great. If you believe nothing more than that, those two should be a multi-million dollar payoff to a young person if that's all they got. Now, if they would put 10% of that money instead of into the target date fund, put it into a small cap value, that might give them an extra million. And that would be nice. But maybe that extra million won't really make that much. And if what will help them say, no, thank you, I've got things taken care of, as a simple, no-load, low-cost, broadly diversified target date fund using index funds. I hope, I think, I believe that should serve you well. Okay, I think I've overdone it today. I've talked too long about something that you probably know plenty about, but I'm hoping, as I said earlier, this is one that you might think about sharing with others in the hopes that every time a broker calls, every time Fisher Investment calls, every time they listen to people on the radio who are saying, load funds are good, index funds, oh, they're okay, but actively managed funds are better. Not the truth. And you can't get it to be the truth by saying it louder. That's the part that is tricky, because the way that they are able to convince people that it is the truth is they say, I really believe it. That doesn't make it so. Thanks for listening.
That was Paul Merriman with Sound Investing. Sound Investing, soundinvesting.com, and paulmerriman.com are produced and exclusively owned by Paul Merriman, who is solely responsible for their content. For more information, free articles, mutual fund recommendations, and more, visit paulmerriman.com.